Welcome to another edition of the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show, where we discuss a Radio IQ news story on Radio Melrose.
U.S. District Judge John Gibney was clear when asked by Virginia Attorney General Jay Jones who should be allowed to vote in the wake of a ruling that found longstanding state law rooted in Jim Crow-era discrimination barred such voters. The defendants shall not deny a person attempting to register to vote or cancel a person's existing registration except for convictions for the following common law felonies, Gibney wrote Monday, before listing 11 such felonies, including arson, manslaughter, rape, and others. But Jones, in a filing last month, sought to amend the ruling to not require, quote, the Commonwealth to facilitate casting of ballots by class members while incarcerated. The legal brief did not explain why his office opposed such voting. Voting while incarcerated, no matter the offense, is legal in Maine and Vermont. Mississippi, Alaska, and Alabama extend the right to some prisoners. As for Monday's ruling, to be clear, the judge wrote, the injunction does not address how prisoners register or vote and imposes no duties on the defendants in that regard. In a statement, a spokesperson for Jones said the AG, quote, looks forward to working with the court to implement the relief ordered by the judge. Vishal Agraharkar is the ACLU attorney on the case.
We think under state law, generally, eligible voters should be able to cast a ballot regardless of where they are. And this should be, you know, a moment about restoring voting rights and correcting a historic injustice.
Judge Gibney set a May 1st deadline for the Virginia Department of Elections to create guidelines for those impacted by his ruling. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Okay, well, thank you. So thanks for joining us, everybody. We're going to talk about the felony voting rights and the story you just heard. And joining us today are
Dana Ackley, author of A Little Book to Save Humanity.
I'm William Fralin, a former member of the Virginia House of Delegates.
Jay Foster with the Praxis Way.
Cynthia Lawrence, head of workforce development at Carilion Clinic.
David Points, retired educator and military.
Lee Learman, physician living in Roanoke.
Joyce Waugh, president Roanoke Regional Chamber, retired.
Wayne Strickland, retired executive director of the Roanoke Valley Allegheny Regional Commission.
Michael Brockta, CIA retired and recent president of the Kiwanis Club of Roanoke.
Okay, so the story talks about a recent federal ruling, which I think, to put in context, my understanding was it said that there were certain enumerated felonies in the Virginia Constitution that if you commit, you lose your right to vote. It had been interpreted, I think, over the years as any felony. So I think that's the controversy. And he said, no, other felonies it doesn't apply to. So the natural question from the ACLU was, that's great. Let's get all these prisoners voting that were convicted of other felonies. And I think that was not what the judge intended. And I believe the attorney general, our new attorney general, probably had a logistical, either a philosophical or a logistical problem with trying to accomplish that. So just wanted to sort of level set. So what do we think about, first of all, should felons be able to vote? Mike.
So what's the impact if they do vote? And what's the impact if they don't? Is there some benefit to society to having these people vote, or is it a negative thing? I don't know the answer to that, but I'd sure be interested in letting that influence my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And just that's a great start, Mike. I would just go to the other end of the spectrum on this in terms of putting things on the table. What are the ethical standards by which we would deny people the most fundamental right of being a U.S. citizen? So beyond the pragmatic outcomes of allowing it or disallowing it, through what basis would we decide to permit it, not permit it, and exactly which type of felon would and would not? So I'd have to go back to see what that original rulemaking looked like in Virginia to see what the justification was, whether it was, I won't say arbitrary and capricious, that's a legal term, I would never say that, but whether it was rooted in something more substantial.
And I don't know the answer, but I do know that there are many rights and responsibilities that are in our Virginia Constitution that were put in at a time of racial segregation and oppression. Not sure about this one. If I had to guess, I would say yeah. But the other piece, though, that I think we ought to consider and see what you guys think, you know, citizenship is a certain number of rights and responsibilities. And when you violate your responsibility, you can lose certain rights. You lose your right to freedom. You lose your right to association. You lose your right to communicate. You lose lots of different freedoms that we all have. This is another one, that your right to vote. And I'm not disputing it's fundamental, because it is. But I don't think it's any more fundamental than some of the other things. Now, when you get out, of course, you restored your freedom, right? You can move about. subject to whether you're on parole or not. Joyce.
Well, just related, I think it's interesting and you know, about what percentage would vote if they could. You know, our voting turnout of regular citizens, non-felons, you know, often is not great. And so I don't know that we would expect any greater percentage of folks whose rights were restored because maybe they weren't convicted of certain felonies. And I don't know what those stats are, but it makes me think that it wouldn't necessarily be much greater than average voters.
Gotcha.
Sometimes the anxiety of things of discussion, in this particular case, the felon voting, I always say the anxiety comes what you don't know, what you don't know, what you don't know. When you have being from Michigan, relocating here to Virginia, when you have a disproportionate amount of people of color in the prison system, and the vote is so close statewide in Virginia or other elections, your fear, regardless of which side of the aisle you're on, is if I give them brothers opportunity to vote, it may change the outcome of the election. And with that picture, people who sit there many times, they feel useless or unaccepted, unappreciated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I need to learn more about how this works in Virginia. I remember in Florida, there was a time where when I was living there that felons lost the right to vote forever. Mm-hmm. Even after they had served their full term and were returned to society.
That's the same rule in Virginia.
And I wonder what that really means in the philosophy of how we implement justice in terms of what it means to serve a term, a sentence, and then have all the other rights restored other than voting. It's hard to make sense of that.
Right, right. And I think the idea is, you know, if you're going to wipe the slate clean, so to speak, maybe you paid your debt, right? You wipe the slate clean. I mean, I understand that's certainly the argument on one side of automatic restoration. Of course, in Virginia, the way it works in Virginia is the governor has to individually restore voting rights for every person that asks for them to be restored, as opposed to an automatic situation. I think some governors have tried to automate that process so that they can do as many as they can, and others have said, no, we're going to do it exactly like it says. You got to apply. We're going to look at them and why you've paid your debt and what all you've paid. I remember there were bills in when I was in the General Assembly, and I believe one of the governors said you couldn't get it restored until you'd paid your restitution, right? Until you'd paid whatever you stole. And of course, that creates a whole nother set of problems because people been in jail, they don't have any money to do the restitution. So, Mike?
And I was thinking about what David Points said. I listened and what I really heard was restricting voting rights for some purpose other than being fair. Restricting voting rights because we don't want a voting block of people to cast their ballot because we might not like the outcome. Yeah, isn't there a little debate going on at the federal level now called the SAVE Act? And hasn't there been a history of back and forth on restricting voting rights? That's a rhetorical question. Of course there has. So I'm looking at this through that same lens. Is this yet one more discussion about one more way to restrict voting rights for one segment of our population?
I certainly think that there's an argument to be made for that. I think the other side of that is you're not doing anything to people that haven't broken the law. You're not going out and systematically disenfranchising one race or another. Now, the effect, and David, I'd be interested to hear from you, the effect of that could be disproportional, and I suspect it probably is.
In addition to disproportional, if we step back for a second and look at the judicial system here in Virginia, I don't have a son, but if I had a son and he decided to go to law school, and he decided to come to practice because one of the attorneys of a large firm contacted me and asked me this question. And I said, do you want the real answer or do you want your answer? So if I had a son, because his granddaughter finished at the University of Virginia Law School, they were taking the bar at the same time. He said, why wouldn't you want your son to practice here? I said, what do most young people want to do in the course of their life? They want to be a what? A judge possibility, a possibility of being a judge. So I said, if he was the same, had the same qualifications as your granddaughter, who are you going to pick? And his response was that magic word, well, if they're qualified. Mm-hmm. So at the top of the judicial system in Virginia, if the judges are appointed, they're going to follow a train of thought that got them there.
Mm-hmm. I got to jump in here just because the late Onslee Ware was just a great, friend of mine.
That's right.
And was the first African-American circuit court judge in Roanoke City or in that circuit, which is Roanoke City and Roanoke County and in Salem. So just wanted to shout out to Onslee. I miss him. That was not asking for a moment of silence.
No. But me and Judge Ware chatted about that.
Yeah.
And it's realistic. So now let's bring the felons in and the people you look like and the judicial system. I'm a little boy and I look up. I don't see any black lawyers. And I see the people making the determination, except for Onslee Ware. They don't look like me. They don't think like me. Mm-hmm. But they're going to give me the hammer. They're going to give me the hammer because it's been historically like that. Mm-hmm. At the dinner table conversation. So what does that do? If Dave's a felon, he comes out, now I'm angry. You're not going to let me vote? Mm-hmm. Now if I'm angry and I want to vote, I may or may not vote for you. So what do? You cut that off. Don't.
So one of the questions that enters into this is whether voting rights ought to be automatically restored, ought to have some merit basis, ought to have some waiting period. Does anybody have any thoughts about the mechanism for restoring voting rights?
Yeah, Dan. No, that I don't. But it just occurs to me that in general, if we're going to ask somebody who gets out of prison to be a responsible citizen, we probably ought to treat them responsibly. We ought to give them the opportunity to be responsible. And if we don't, what are their options at that point? What are we teaching them to do?
Yeah, I think we need to remember that felon is a word and it's a label and it brings up all sorts of presuppositions in our heads when we hear it. And some of those presuppositions would last the whole life of that person, mm-hmm. Even though they may have completely fulfilled what justice requires for them. And we know from a statistical perspective that the older they are, the less likely they are to have a repeat felony offense. I don't know many facts, but that's one I know, that age is a predictor in the setting of parole of repeat offense. So why would we take someone who'd completed, the justice process has been completed, they have decades left of their life, they carry with them the identity of a former felon when they answer their questionnaire for employment. Why would we other them to the extent that they would not be able to vote? That's passing a life sentence for someone who's actually already completed their sentence.
Right. You are listening to the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show, where we discuss a Radio IQ news story on Radio Melrose. Let me ask you this, Lee. We've got a lot of people want to weigh in, so I'll get to everybody. I think we sometimes take the person that committed a crime at their youth and then they got out and they sort of straightened up. What about the person who's been in six times? What about the murderer? What about the rapist? It's okay. Let them out. Let them vote. Is that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that as we heard the story, we heard around a subset of felons that were in this category. And it would be helpful to sit down and have a really difficult deliberative conversation. Yeah. Around whether it's the number of offenses or the severity of even a single offense, whether those would be the circumstances. I would love to have that conversation occur by the folks who would be gathered around to do it, and so that the implementation of that would be fair and equitable instead of relying on one person's opinion in the governor's office.
Even if they're elected by the people.
Right.
Right, okay. Jay.
One thought that comes to mind is kind of goes back to Mike's question. Actually, just the motivation in general. What is the motivation behind these laws? Because on one hand, it could be it's a punitive process and you've done something so bad, you're going to lose your right to vote for the rest of your life. Well, that's a pretty severe punishment. But then on the other side, there's a possible motive, which Mike is bringing up, is the state actually is trying to influence the outcome of elections using this process. And you talk about disenfranchising somebody. If you could accuse them of a crime, convict them, and they've lost their right to vote for the rest of their lives, it's a great way to take them out of the equation. So what's the motive?
Wayne?
Well, it's not just voting. If you have a felony on your record in getting a job, trying to get a job, then you may not get a job for the rest of your life unless it's something that doesn't require you to fill out a form. And I know a lot of organizations back a few years ago said they were taking the felon checkpoint off their job application. You still have to vet the person, but that felon, just seeing that on there, you just throw the job application away.
Well, and in our healthcare world, there are a lot of what they call barrier crimes, where if you're convicted of a certain types of crimes, you cannot hire that person or you're liable for that. Yep. So it's an interesting question.
That is correct. Let me just jump in and give a personal anecdote. So back to restorative justice, and you mentioned if there's someone who committed a crime in their youth and was convicted, I do have some experience with mentoring a young woman who had that very experience, and she has turned her life around. And I want to tell you that her most precious act is to go and vote. She was so excited when she first got out to be able to go do that because she felt like she was back a part of society. So I would say that there's a couple of sides to this. I don't know what the list is on the Constitution that lists the offenses, but I would assume, back to your comment about rights and responsibilities, that they are violent offenses against your fellow citizens.
I'm certain they're not all violent offenses.
Wouldn't the possession of marijuana, maybe not now, but before, if you possess marijuana, you are a felon?
You can't vote for the rest of your life.
That's right.
Right.
Wow.
Right. Well, and that's interesting about this case, is the case was saying, in some ways, turning the original intent on its head and saying, okay, the original intent said these felons, and it lists them in the Constitution, felonies rather. And at the time, there weren't a lot of other felonies, but now there are, right? And so what does that mean for what's covered and what's not covered?
And I don't know if our legislators think about the impact of creating a law that says this act you did is a felony. I mean, not a misdemeanor, a felony. Once you have that felony on there, your life changes.
Well, it's interesting. When you put in a bill in the General Assembly to create a new felony and a period of incarceration, you have to put in what's called the Woodrum Statement. Some of us around will remember Chip Woodrum, who was a delegate years and years ago, and he got tired of everybody putting these things in, and then the state had to pay for the incarceration. So you have to come up with the amount of money it would cost and the number of people that they would estimate would be convicted of that and how much that would cost. You have to put in a budget amendment to pay for it so that we could get a little bit of handle on some of the, some of those issues, which seems to me to be relatively fair. And it's still done to this day.
And
go ahead, Dave.
Consider the dinner table conversations in certain communities when some are accused and convicted guilty of a felon, and sometimes that same felon process, another court case may say it's a misdemeanor, the disparity there. And it hurts people of color or poor people. That's another reason to look at the disparity between giving that person the right to vote. Again, it's a side way of taking them out the process or the system.
Let's talk about drugs for a second, because that came up and I hadn't thought about it, but I know that one of the positions of people that want automatic restoration is at least drug offenses ought to be restored. There's certainly a physical health aspect to drug addiction. There's certainly a mental health aspect to drug addiction that when that gets overcome, it's a cause for celebration, not for punitive matters. I don't know if that brings any.
We go back to this.
We're jumping on leagues.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Explain
so
yourself.
We understand that society decides to treat as unlawful certain drug offenses. And depending on how much the quantity is of drugs that are found on a person, they could be presumed to be selling those drugs, which would then make them a different type of person when it comes to, their sentencing and felony status and all that. But in healthcare, we believe that it also is reflective of an underlying medical condition, either one that started with prescription opiates, which we know to be true, or ones that started with self-treatment through street drugs for mental illnesses and other issues. And so there are a variety of ways that we can help people more than ever before in terms of getting off of those drugs and living the rest of their life with great care to not have a relapse of that. So the two worlds don't really meet up very well, the legal world and the medical world. except in certain circumstances. For example, healthcare workers that are found to use drugs can get into an arrangement with the medical board, for example, in ways that helps them to rehabilitate themselves and return to practice. So in certain subsets, we are using what I would call a more just approach that acknowledges an illness is present, but also that there is a need to have some societal, you know, look at the behavior and monitoring moving forward. So it would be a shame to take this illness that has treatments behind it and then for the rest of that person's life, deny them the right to vote. That would go against
them. Yeah, to David Poyntz's point, Onsley Ware was a big believer of the drug court. The drug court was actually started in Roanoke by Diane Strickland when she was a judge and actually had deferred sentences, right? Said, okay, if there were certain eligibility criteria, but you've got to come in, you've got to get treatment, you got to do your stuff, you got, you know, not, it wasn't, you know, it didn't always work. But when it did work, I suspect it was very powerful and avoided maybe some of the, what do you doctors say, sequela of, help me out here?
Sequelae.
Sequelae.
Consequences.
Consequences for me, of that conviction. Right, you can defer it and see what happens. David may ask, well, how often does that happen? I don't know the answer to that question.
It has to be fair, but Mike, go on.
You're Mike.
Oh, I just wanted to remind our listeners that they can listen to these programs on Sundays on Radio Melrose, and they can play back recordings of these programs if they visit the RoanokeCollaboration.org website.
Well done. And they could also, when they go on that website, look at our pledge and decide if they would like to take our pledge, which is...
What pledge is that?
It's you help me.
The collaborative discussion pledge.
Is that what it is? I don't think that's right.
No, something. Think so. I think on, the Mike, word dialogue is in there.
Collaborative dialogue. Thank you.
Constructive dialogue.
Constructive dialogue pledge.
Sometimes it's good to, I've always said, we need groups like this to have communication, not for an end result, but at least to discuss some ideas so we can agree to find a solution. The dinner table conversations, again, when we talk about drug, many times those who can use the medical avenue in terms of to separate is wealth. Poor people don't have that access, and they're the ones that are hit hardest. It doesn't make a difference if you're black or white at that level. If you're poor, you get the system. Rich people can go to treatment programs over and over and over again. And so these are the type of demonstrations, conversations they have at the community. Why did Uncle Ray Ray or Uncle Poo Poo, why did they go? Because they had one joint. I know that John Sinclair in Michigan years ago went to jail in Michigan for one joint. One joint. Years. Now you get one joint. What is it?
Well, actually, in Virginia, they've legalized possession of marijuana under a certain amount, I believe. And there's another whole question here about the economic drivers of the drug trade. And is there a reason people get involved with that rather than going and getting a job doing manual labor, for example? You know, there may be reasons. Yeah, Mike.
This is a bit of sarcasm. They probably get into it because they're not allowed to vote.
Well, that...
Moving along, the economic disadvantage, when people are desperate, they do desperate things, and they don't. If they don't have opportunity, what are they going to do to feed themselves and feed others? Yeah. So we need to figure out how not to have people be so desperate economically.
Right. Well, and the economic. Got to be careful because I wasn't raised in that world. I don't know, but the lure of, I'm not sure it's all about putting food on the table. Some of it's a new watch and a new car and, having fun and all the other stuff, that can go along with that. And then we've got a gang problem, right? And is there an issue where if somebody, I'm really sort of stretching here, but if somebody joins a gang in order to be safe, right? And now they're a member of a gang and now they get caught up in something and now they're a felon and they can't vote. You can see that happen. Yeah,
I'm going to take it away from the judge for a second real quick. When I was growing up we go to the barbershop and the guy used to come back. If you know the three races at the racetrack, there were certain races and they would give the number, three numbers, and you have a piece of paper. In the back of the barbershop, the guys come in and do the numbers. There was so much money going in the underground, then state said, well, we need to have a lottery. Well, those individuals who were caught selling the numbers in the community did long term in jail. But the process was taken from wherever that came from, organized crime, to where they make millions of dollars now in the lottery. So we take that in terms of drugs. You sell the drugs, you become a pharmacist without a license working out of your trunk of the car. It happens quite a bit, the parallel of money. And I agree with Dana, because it's all about economics.
Yeah.
Quick fix.
Joyce?
No, I was just going to say, like, a quick fix compared with it taking, you know, weeks, you know, at $10 or $15 an hour compared with, you know, what you can get in a short period of time. Sure.
But before we go, I wanted to just point out one of the problems in this that created this story was, okay, if you believe that felons ought to be able to vote, should they be able to vote while they're in jail?
Well, that was the story, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I agree.
We
I would add a caveat to that. How are they going to get the information to make their decision? And that would require some sort of organizational part on the incarceration system.
I suspect that was part of the concern of the Attorney General. Mm-hmm. How do I, and then do you have equal access for parties, for candidates, for, you know, it is interesting that felons can't vote, but I remember this from the, we're not going to go to the redistricting. I'm not going to go down redistricting right now, but I do remember this from some of that. Those people all count. Do they count where they're from, or do they count in Wise County where there are 300 inmates?
Great point.
Right?
You like know,
where, students. Where's the representation come from? So yeah,
I would add this. In Norway, the prison system treats prisoners as if they were actual human beings. And the recidivism rate is a mere fraction of ours. Just maybe there's a connection there.
Dana, is that true for violent criminals as well?
I don't have it broken down, but to my understanding, they treat them like human beings. They may not let them loose on society, but it isn't that one up, one down, and I'm going to take advantage of you mentality.
But respectfully, David, Norway versus the United States of the diversity, we have to look at that.
Well, we could still treat people like human beings.
I agree with that part, but disproportionately, it's going to be people of poor, lower status or of color that are going to be fighting for their rights to vote.
Well, I suspect the poor are everywhere, but they're white poor, perhaps, in
Norway.
I
did say that.
Well, but the point is, if people are trained and taught how to be more human and behave normally, what we would consider sort of within certain bounds while they're in prison, then they're more likely to do so once they are out of prison, including voting.
Yeah, and I haven't heard these debates over and over the years. Sometimes you get in a situation, all right, what about the victim? Mm-hmm. So we're going to do a lot for this person that did something wrong. We're going to restore their voting rights. We're going to make sure they're being treated humanely. We're going to make sure they got a bed and they're not, you know, and all this stuff. And then, you know, but my daddy's dead. Right. And so it's an emotional situation as well that probably has to be talked about. Yeah, David.
No, go. Wrap it up.
Okay. Well, any further final thoughts on this matter? Okay, you've been listening to the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show, where we discuss a Radio IQ news story on Radio Melrose.